This is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the White House says it's outraged by reports of snipers and live rounds being used against Ukrainian protesters, as dozens more die in Independence Square.
There have definitely been live rounds used. I've seen police officers shooting Kalashnikovs at demonstrators, and I've seen several people who had gunshot wounds.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker comes under fire over a campaign finance probe. Our correspondent has the story. Three Al Jazeera journalists plead not guilty to alleged terror charges in a Cairo court. And we look at Facebook's $19 billion deal for WhatsApp.
And if WhatsApp can help them be more relevant every day to more users, then for that reason alone, it's very interesting to Facebook.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The White House is urging Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to withdraw security forces from the center of Kiev, saying it's outraged at the violence there. Doctors in the Ukrainian capital say at least 70 anti-government protesters have been killed in violent clashes with police. The White House is urging the Ukrainian military not to get further involved in the conflict, saying the unrest should be resolved politically. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Lorna Shaddock reports.
In a strongly worded statement, the White House says it is outraged at the images of Ukrainian security forces firing automatic weapons on their own people. It also calls on President Yanukovych to withdraw all troops from downtown Kiev and stresses that the US will work with European allies to hold accountable all those responsible for the recent violence. The statement comes after the US State Department announced on Wednesday that it's blocked 20 senior members of the Ukrainian government from travelling to the US, saying they were complicit in the violence which led to the deaths of protesters. President Obama also said there would be consequences if Ukraine failed to restore calm in a battle which increasingly appears to be pitting Russia against the US and its Western European allies.
And correspondent Gulliver Cragg is in Kiev.
I've seen police officers shooting Kalashnikovs at demonstrators, and I've seen several people who had gunshot wounds. Many of them were brought into the hotel. It's been turned into A sort of improvised field hospital where wounded demonstrators are being treated.
The European Union is imposing sanctions on Ukraine with immediate effect. Asset freezes and travel bans are among the measures being taken, with Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague calling them a response to widespread horror over events in Kiev. In Egypt, 20 people, including four foreign journalists, have gone on trial, accused of spreading false information and aiding or joining a terrorist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood. A guilty sentence could mean many years in jail or, for some, the death penalty. The reporters, three of whom work for Al Jazeera, have denied the charges and say they're facing harsh and inhumane conditions in jail. Correspondent Bel True was in the court.
It had two recesses in which the three jailed Al Jazeera correspondents basically shouted out that they hadn't been given proper access to their lawyers before the hearing, or they didn't even know the proper date of the court hearing, which they'd managed to get from their families, but hadn't been properly informed by the authorities. So basically their message was that this case in this courtroom was pretty disorganised.
India's Supreme Court has blocked the release of three people jailed for more than 20 years in connection with the assassination of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. The three had their death sentences commuted just earlier this week. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. An investigation by a top human rights organization is slamming the US military over a drone strike in Yemen last December. Human Rights Watch says the strike killed at least 12 people and failed to comply with rules laid out by President Barack Obama. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Nina Maria Potts reports.
Human Rights Watch says the drone strike in Yemen in December, which was carried out by the US military's Joint Special Operations Command, targeted a convoy of vehicles that were part of a wedding procession. The human rights group says the evidence shows that some, if not all, those who were killed were civilians. The issue of US drone strikes and civilian casualties has stirred intense debate in Washington over the past year. In Yemen, the strike in December provoked outrage, where many believe the attacks fuel sympathy for militants. The Human Rights Watch report also contradicts the US government line that only militants were killed in that attack. And the White House generally has refused to release any figures on the numbers of civilian deaths in US drone strikes.
A former top aide to Rupert Murdoch has been acquitted of one of the criminal charges she faced in a phone hacking trial at London's Old Bailey. Rebecca Brooks has been cleared of a claim that she committed misconduct in public office. From FSN's London Bureau, Elena Cassas reports.
She'd been accused of authorising a Sun reporter to pay a serving soldier £4,000 for a picture of Prince William in a bikini at a fancy dress party. The judge said there was no case to answer. The former editor still faces two charges of conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, one of conspiracy to make illegal payments, and one of conspiracy to hack voicemail messages, all of which she denies. On Wednesday, the trial made headlines after prosecutors said she'd been advised by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who apparently told her to toughen up.
Keep following us on Twitter for more on the Ukraine crisis. We're there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Dozens have been killed and many more injured in another deadly day of violent protests in the Ukrainian capital. As the death toll grew, EU leaders in Brussels agreed to impose visa and asset sanctions against Ukrainian officials they considered responsible for the bloodshed. The White House said it was outraged by reports of sniper fire and images showing live rounds being used by police against anti-government supporters. Earlier, I spoke to Kiev-based journalist Gulliver Cragg.
There have definitely been live rounds used. I've seen police officers shooting Kalashnikovs at demonstrators, and I've seen several people who had gunshot wounds. Many of them were brought into the Hotel Ukraina, which is the big hotel on top of the hill that overlooks Independence Square. It's been turned into a sort of improvised field hospital where wounded demonstrators are being treated. That's in the lobby of the hotel. I saw five dead bodies in the lobby of the hotel, and of mine have confirmed that they've seen another three on the square itself, but I think the death toll is actually higher than that. Ukrainian media are reporting as many as 28 people dead. There are a few thousand demonstrators there who are building new barricades to try to protect the square.
There had been suggestions yesterday of a truce between the government and protest leaders. Clearly, that's not the case following this latest wave of violence.
There was a truce declared yesterday evening, which meant that the police did not try to storm the square and destroy the rest of the protest camp during the night. But that doesn't mean that the night was quiet. There were still a lot of protesters and a lot of police on the square, and they were sporadically throwing Molotov cocktails at each other, and the police, it sounded like they were using stun grenades. These are the bloodiest days in Ukraine's history as an independent country, and it's something that's leaving most Ukrainians deeply traumatized.
And the ranks of the protesters, are they only growing, or have the recent spate of deaths and injuries put people off coming into Maidan Square?
The ranks are growing, but not by such dramatic amounts as the protest leaders might be hoping for. I think that there certainly are a lot of people who are scared. There's a combination of things that some people are turning away from the protest because they're scared, perhaps also because they're not happy with the behavior of some of the more fearsome, more radical elements among the protesters, who certainly have been giving as good as they get, to the extent that they can when they aren't armed with Kalashnikovs in terms of these clashes. So there's that aspect, and there's the aspect that the government is making it difficult to get to the centre of Kiev by closing down roads and the metro system. But on the other hand, there are people who are coming and who are resorting to violence in a way that they never thought that they would, because they have just got so angry with the way that they've seen the police behaving and the determination to make no compromises and cling to power no matter what happens that Viktor Yanukovych seems to be showing. But certainly, I do think that although this situation is highly, highly dramatic, and one doesn't want to understate it at all, it is quite important for people who aren't here to realize that there's just a few thousand people on Independence Square right now. There's a few hundred people probably involved in the clashes, and then there are clashes taking place in a few other cities in Ukraine. But this is far from being a situation where the whole country is engulfed by violence. That may yet happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
Following the dismissal of the head of the armed forces by Viktor Yanukovych yesterday, could we see, or is there some fear that there will be a military role involved in these protests?
There is a great fear that there will be a military role in these protests because there has been the announcement that the government was conducting an anti-terrorist operation. That's according to a law that was passed in last year. That's according to a law that was passed in April 2013 on how to combat terrorism, and that gives the police and army the right to detain people, search them, and gives the army the right to join in these operations and to use weapons. And so there was even a post on the military's website outlining exactly what powers this anti-terrorist operation declaration gives them. So in many ways, what we're seeing is a sort of de facto state of emergency with the curtailment of transport and the threats from the military that they're going to get involved. So it's not just that people are worried that the military may get involved. The military has basically said they are going to get involved. The question is, in what way and to what degree, and how violent is the regime really prepared to allow this situation to get some people, optimists you might call them, but maybe they're also well-informed optimists, do believe that the military won't be prepared to use the kind of force against the protesters that would be necessary to really clear the square. As one protester put it to me, sure, they shoot us, and sure, they're trying to clear the square, but they're not. In order to really get us to leave, they'd have to come along with a Kalashnikov and gun us all down, and you won't find a soldier in the Ukrainian army who'd be prepared to do that kind of thing against women and children.
Gulliver Cragg in Ukraine's capital. To discuss the international response to the brutal scenes unfolding in Kiev, I spoke to former MP and activist Ole Rybachuk, one of the protest leaders at the forefront of the anti-government movement. I began by asking him if the EU's decision to enforce sanctions against Ukrainian officials would be welcomed by the protesters.
Better late than never. I was always referring EU to United States because, well, EU is saying it's easier for the states to take decisions. You have your State Department, you have President, and EU needs 28 countries' consensus vote. But I guess my government or my President convinced all EU members that the only way to deal with this kind of people is, in one phrase, hit their wallet.
Does the protest movement feel like the international community has been doing enough? Or do they? Would they like to see more action coming from Washington and supportive EU leaders?
US is now clearly leading here. I didn't know to what extent EU countries would be able to act unanimously, and I'm happy they did. This is desperately needed, and this is the only effective way to deal with people with this mentality who are practically acting as criminals, who are not understanding this talks on values, respect, human rights, etc., but they immediately understand what it comes to their own rights, to their own restrictions, to their own wallets. So this must be effective. And there was a huge positive outcry here when U.S. announced about 20 top Ukrainian officials and businessmen who got under sanctions. And today's news from EU is very encouraging.
Are Mr. Yanukovych's days in office as the president of Ukraine numbered?
I have no doubt he has no political future. There is already some news, not confirmed, that his two sons boarded private planes and left the country. Again, it is not confirmed, but probably the probability is very high, because what he did is unprecedented. You cannot actually hope to survive in the country where you are the first president who killed hundreds of innocent people. In the crowd of 10,000, who is the terrorist, who is not? For example, today they shot and killed a 20-year-old or 18-year-old volunteer girl who was wearing a big Red Cross, and still she got a bullet in her head. This is how anti-terrorism is understood by this I guess, psychologically unbalanced people who are now in my government and in law enforcement. And right now it's very tense. So MPs are having the meeting. Probably they might find some solutions. Law enforcement has moved out of barricades. The whole Maidan is not burning anymore, but you can feel shock and tension.
Former MP and activist Oleh Rybachuk. This is FSN Reports. Thousands of incriminating emails from the staff of Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin were made public by a judge this week, and the ongoing corruption investigation could threaten the political career of one of the Republican Party's most popular rising stars. Several of Governor Walker's aides have already been convicted for secretly campaigning for him on public time, but new evidence suggests Walker himself was aware of and possibly involved in criminal wrongdoing. Our correspondent, Alice Olsen, has the details.
The Wisconsin Court of Appeals ordered the publication Wednesday of about 28,000 emails related to a secret John Doe investigation around Scott Walker's 2010 campaign for governor. The emails and court papers show that Walker's aides, when he was still county executive of Milwaukee, set up a secret wireless router in his office to exchange emails about the campaign while on the clock at their government jobs. Walker has denied that he knew about or was involved in any of this, and both he and his political allies have dismissed the investigation as a witch hunt. But Jay Heck with the political watchdog group Common Cause of Wisconsin said the public should be taking this very seriously.
District attorneys do not undertake investigations of these sorts unless they have some pretty hard evidence that there was criminal wrongdoing. In the first John Doe investigation, even though it didn't lead all the way up to Walker, six people were criminally charged and convicted. My guess is that they'll unearth wrongdoing in the second John Doe investigation. Whether that leads up to Walker is anyone's guess, but it's certainly not very helpful to Walker in his reelection year for governor, and certainly casts a shadow over any presidential ambitions he may have for 2016.
According to state prosecutors, Walker's former deputy chief of staff, Kelly Reinfleisch, was involved with nearly 3,500 emails between members of the campaign, most of them sent or received during normal business hours, when she was working her $60,000 a year county job. Another employee, Darlene Wink, was caught posting pro-Walker comments on different websites during work time. And another former deputy chief of staff, Tim Russell, was convicted of stealing more than $27,000 from a fund for veterans. There's also a second ongoing investigation into possible illegal coordination between Governor Walker's recall campaign in 2012 and Club for Growth and more than two dozen other conservative political groups. These groups ran millions of dollars worth of advertising against Walker's opponent in that race, and Walker came out victorious by a healthy margin, despite months of organizing against him by unions and progressive groups. Madison-based activist and writer Carl Gibson said he hopes the recent revelations spur the local groups that occupied the state capitol in 2012 to continue protesting and pushing for reform.
I would like to see accountability handed out. I would like to see indictments, not just for Walker's aides, but for Walker himself. I would like to see a fair election. And in the long run, you know, to avoid further corruption in the future, would love to see publicly funded elections. Would love to see, you know, elections that are free from the influence of big money.
Governor Walker will be running for re-election this November, and it's expected to be a contentious and expensive battle. Jay Heck with Common Cause says while publicly financed elections are an unlikely goal, this whole episode shows a desperate need for better transparency laws when it comes to corporate money in politics.
A lot of money that was poured into Wisconsin during the recall election from all over the country that we don't even know where it came from. We don't know who the donors are. We think the people of Wisconsin deserve to know who's trying to influence their vote during an election. And so we're pushing hard for a disclosure of this outside money. And, you know, that I think would also shed some light on if there is any illegal activity, you know, who it's with and who are the outside individuals that may have engaged in illegal activity with the Walker campaign.
Heck compared these recent revelations about Walker, who he referred to as a national conservative hero, with the recent corruption scandal surrounding Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, saying both men will now have a cloud over them if they do decide to run for president in 2016. In Washington, I'm Alice Holstein.
Three Al Jazeera journalists being held in Egypt have pleaded not guilty to charges of joining or aiding and abetting a terrorist organization. The three men are among 20 people facing charges of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, the group outlawed by the military-backed interim government following the overthrow of President Mohamed Morsi in July. The men, who have been in detention since December, could face up to 15 years in prison. Earlier, I spoke to Cairo-based journalist Belle True, who was at the trial.
The first hearing of the trial of 20 defendants, which includes several Al Jazeera reporters, begun today, and it was fairly chaotic. It had two recesses in which the three jailed Al Jazeera correspondents basically shouted out that they hadn't been given proper access to their lawyers before the hearing, or they didn't even know the proper date of the court hearing, which they'd managed to get from their families, but hadn't been properly informed by the authorities. So basically their message was that this case and this courtroom was pretty disorganized and a bit of a sham.
You were in the court earlier today when the defendants were describing the conditions of their detention. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Al Jazeera producer Mohamed Fahmy has been now in jail for over 50 days, and he sustained an injury to his shoulder. It is, in fact, broken, and he's not received any medical treatment for it since being in jail. He was held in solitary confinement in the maximum security section of Cairo's Toura prison for over a month, where he was basically kept in a windowless cell full of insects without a bed. Now, their treatment has improved in the last few weeks, but there are five other defendants in the courtroom today who do not belong to Al Jazeera, and they said that they had actually, in fact, been subjected to torture. The five appeared to be young men, including the son of prominent Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed El-Beltagi, and they said they'd been electrocuted, starved, beaten. One of them said they'd had cigarettes put out on his body. So although the three Al Jazeera reporters have been kept in solitary confinement with only 1 hour of sunlight every day, it's really the other defendants who've been treated in a more harsh manner, receiving torture and threats.
Can you remind us the nature of these charges, why these men have been detained?
The Egyptian government and the authorities are accusing the 20 defendants of either joining or assisting a terrorist organization and spreading false news. The 16 Egyptian defendants are being charged with joining a terrorist organization, which is thought to be the Muslim Brotherhood, and basically spreading information that's false to cause disunity among in the country. Now, the four foreigners are being charged with assisting this terrorist organization by providing funds, equipment and information, and also spreading false information that harms the country. So these are very strong charges. For the Egyptians, this could mean the death penalty if the judiciary decides to take it far enough. For the foreigners, they could be in jail for between 5 to 15 years if they're also found guilty. So this is a really very serious trial that these people are facing.
And the trial has now been adjourned till a later date.
The trial has been adjourned to the 5th of March. The lawyers need that much time to go through the extensive case file, which is apparently 500 pages long, look at all the evidence. Then what will happen next is we'll have the prosecution witnesses who will be there in court giving their testimonies. In the meantime, the three Al Jazeera reporters told us in the courtroom that they just want to find out what's going on because they have so little contact with their lawyers and with their families. And like I said, they didn't even know the proper date of their hearing. So I think in the next month, we're going to see the lawyers really try to get to grips with this evidence and these charges, which the US government called spurious and which Human Rights Watch have condemned as being massively arbitrary. So it's going to be a difficult few months for these reporters who refused bail today as well. So they're going to remain in jail in Cairo for the foreseeable future.
Belle Chu in Cairo. $19 billion, the eye-watering price Facebook announced it will pay for the mobile messaging service WhatsApp. The app, an SMS alternative, gives its 450 million monthly users unlimited free text messages. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg said WhatsApp was on a path to connecting 1 billion people. To find out if the product justifies the price tag, I spoke to Nate Elliott, an analyst with global research firm Forrester, specializing in social media.
Facebook has spent the past several years working tirelessly to find new reasons to keep people coming back to its sites and its services and to keep its users engaged. And sometimes they do that by innovating on their own, coming up with their own good ideas. Sometimes they do it by stealing good ideas from competitors. Sometimes they do it by buying competitors outright. And we've seen them pursue all of those different strategies in terms of innovating the PC experience over the past several years. And in the last 12 months, they've turned their attention very heavily towards mobile. Right? They've introduced Facebook Home and Facebook Paper. They've relaunched their mobile Messenger app as well as their basic mobile Facebook application. And now we see them, in addition to developing their own good ideas for mobile, we see them pursuing that same sort of multi-pronged strategy on the mobile side that they've long pursued on the PC side. So this really is part of a bigger, longer story of them always looking for new ways to keep people engaged, and the more recent story of them turning that focus especially to the mobile space.
For people out there who aren't among those 450 million people using the service each month, can you just explain exactly what it is and how it works?
Yeah, it's what you would call over-the-top messaging. So really, it's very similar to the texting or the SMS functionality that already exists on most mobile phones. The difference is it uses mobile data to pass messages along instead of using the SMS networks, and that means that that the messaging ultimately is free except for the data charges. It makes it much cheaper for users to send text and images to users on different networks and especially to users in different countries.
WhatsApp is enjoying something in the region of 1 million user additions per day. So what are Facebook planning to ultimately to do with WhatsApp? What's their long view for this?
I'm not sure that they fully understand what the business opportunity is here, but they've gone ahead with acquisitions in the past without necessarily having an ironclad business opportunity. You know, Facebook looks at this from two perspectives. The first is how can they be the most relevant set of social services to the largest number of people? And if WhatsApp can help them be more relevant every day to more users, then for that reason alone, it's very interesting to Facebook. It's notable that Facebook acquired Instagram almost 2 years ago when Instagram had no revenue stream at all, and people questioned that deal. But the reality is, in retrospect, it's looking like a pretty good deal. Instagram's user base has grown very aggressively in the past couple of years. Marketers are saying they're happy with the level of brand interactions they're getting on Instagram. And the early response to Instagram's paid ad offering has been pretty good as well. So, you know, when we look at WhatsApp, I imagine that that Facebook will want to mimic what they did with the Instagram deal and give WhatsApp the resources to keep growing its user base, to keep offering new features and functionality to that user base, and then over time look for ways to better monetize that user base. But it is worth noting that unlike Instagram, WhatsApp actually does have some revenue at this point. They charge for the actual application, and so they've got many users who are paying to use their service right now.
Nate Elliott with global research firm Forrester. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Friday, our special extended interview with former Weather Underground activist Bill Ayres. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Foster and Simon Marks on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.